Our Civil War was not just a struggle between the North and the South, and in the eastern part of our country, there was another area in play, and that was the West. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Today, we're going to be talking about the Western War, who was involved and what control of the West meant to all sides. And there were not just two sides, there were three sides. To understand what was going on, we have Megan Nelson with us by phone today. Megan Kate Nelson is a writer and historian. Her topics have included the Civil War, U.S. Western history, and American culture. She has a B.A. in history and literature from Harvard, and her Ph.D. in American studies from the University of Iowa. Her new book is titled The Three-Cornered War, and the subtitle, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. So are you familiar with what was going on in the West during the Civil War? What questions do you have about the groups involved? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Megan Nelson, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on, Larry.
Well, I tell you what, I have the Civil War has always been a fascinating time for me. And I looked at my library of Civil War books the other night, and I probably have 75 books or so on the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And as I looked at them, I tried to remember when there was any in-depth discussion of the West. I could not come up with any, as a matter of fact. So I so much looked forward to and then enjoyed your book, The Three-Cornered War. How did you become interested in that part?
Well, I had a similar reaction to yours, actually, when I started to really think about and teach Civil War history. My previous book, Ruined Nation, was also about the Civil War. And so when I was doing research for that, I discovered that there were these battles between the Union and the Confederacy in New Mexico territory. And then I also discovered that Apaches and Navajos were involved in this conflict. And I couldn't believe it. I was completely astonished because I grew up in Colorado. And I had no idea. I never learned about any of this in any of my classes or in any local history museums. You know, usually the Western history you get is about pioneers and gold and silver mining. And if you hear about Native people, and you do, it's mostly in the context of the Indian Wars of the 1870s and 80s. And so I had no idea that there was a conflict in this region and that Colorado soldiers were involved in serving in the Union Army to defend the West against Confederate invasion. And so that really is what launched the project. I wanted to figure out kind of what happened. And I also wanted to figure out why I didn't know about it and why so few Americans do, even people who live in the West.
It's really fascinating. And I right from the start, I was fascinated by, you know, the reasons for the battles that occurred. Both the Confederates and the Union really wanted that land. And explain why.
Yeah, sure. So this was one of my other questions, was why would they even want to be there in the first place? Most of the major, you know, the armies are amassing in the Eastern Theater. It's very clear early in the war that Virginia is going to be the major battleground. And one of the things that always interested me is, you know, when we talk about the coming of the Civil War, when we talk about all of the things that drove the North and the South to battle, we're always talking about the West. Right? We're talking about the Mexican-American War. We're talking about all of the territories that we got in that war and later by purchase, and, you know, how the North and the South disagreed on what they were going to do with those territories. Would slavery be expanded into those territories? And then when we start to talk about the war itself, it's like everyone forgets that the war in the West even existed. But it did exist, and they still, the Union and the Confederacy, really wanted both of them to keep control or get control over the West, and for three really major reasons. One was gold mines. You know, it's extremely expensive to fight wars, and you have to pay for them somehow. So the Confederacy in particular wanted access to those gold mines because they were a little bit on the back foot financially at the beginning of the war. Then they also wanted access to those Pacific ports, particularly California and Southern California, those deep water ports around San Diego and Los Angeles, because they needed to be able to ship their cotton out, again, to fund the war. And, of course, the Union wanted to keep both of those things out of Confederate hands. And then also something that people don't really talk about very much is the importance of the West in both the Union and the Confederacy's visions of the future. So that the Confederacy really saw the West as a continuation of their vision before the war, which was as a continental empire of slavery. They thought they would expand all the way to the Pacific coast, establish slavery everywhere, and then actually start moving southward into Mexico and Latin America. And the Union, on the other hand, saw the West as kind of the center of their empire of free labor, that slavery would not exist anywhere in the United States, and the West would be the place in which, predominantly white farmers, but also possibly black farmers as well, would labor freely. And, of course, that necessitated for both the Union and the Confederacy kind of removing Native Americans from the West, where they had their homelands and were defending them.
Yeah, and as you think about it, and the Apache, particularly, I think the Apache were outstanding fighters, outstanding militarists, and it was their land, kind of, you know.
Absolutely, yes.
Their land. So that whole story of the bringing together of these three groups was really, really fascinating to me. And you tell the story kind of through the eyes, in a way, of nine different people.
I do, yes. I figured out pretty early on that the story of the war in this region was really complicated and that it was fought by a number of different, very diverse communities and over huge, vast stretches of the southwestern landscape. And so as I was thinking about how I was going to actually tell this story in a way that made sense and make all the arguments I wanted to make, but then also give readers a really good sense of what this conflict was like on the ground, I decided to actually steal a strategy from our friends, the fiction writers, who have been using a lot lately multi-perspective narrative. That kind of structure that you see in a lot of novels and actually also in television shows now, where you see events from different perspectives.
Yeah.
And you move through time and you come back to them. And so I identified nine people who were all part of, they were part of different communities, and they all took part in Civil War actions. And by kind of following them, the reader could really gain a sense of what the stakes were for that community, the kinds of actions that they took, and then how they each experienced the war differently.
Yeah, it's really a great way to tell it, and you're such a good writer. And
thank you.
You really bring the story to life, and I think it's a wonderful approach to doing it, to telling the story. And you had some really great people to talk with, and we're going to have a chance to flesh that out and to talk some more with Megan Nelson. Her book is called The Three-Cornered War. We'll visit about Canby, Canby was the, Carleton was, let me think, Carleton was the Union colonel, Kit Carson, the frontiersman, Juanita was the Navajo woman, I'm sure I'm remembering that correctly, and many, many more. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Megan Kate Nelson, author of The Three-Cornered War. You're going to like it. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking about what was going on in the Western United States during the Civil War? Well, war was going on, and our guest Megan Nelson has written a great book. It's called The Three-Cornered War, The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. And I'm guessing that you are like me and don't know a whole lot about what went on. At least I didn't until I had a chance to read her book. It's a fascinating read. And if you have questions about the war in the West, questions... Maybe you might have even had some relatives that were involved in the fights, the battles that went on over there. I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We have Fred from Madison on with a question that, Megan, we lost Fred. He wondered about James Doty and his role in the Civil War, but I don't think James Doty was ever in the West, was he, into your memory?
No, I don't think I ever ran into him in this particular theater. And this may be one of those cases. One of the things that I'm trying to do in this book is to kind of reframe what exactly is the West in terms of Civil War history.
Yeah.
Because one of the strange quirks in the study of this field is that Civil War historians often refer to the Trans-Mississippi as the West. And so that makes it very hard to imagine what might be west of West, right? So there was a lot of action in the Trans-Mississippi Theater, which a lot of historians have been paying attention to, especially recently. And all of those actions are extremely important. But my focus is more on what is going on between the Pacific Coast and the 100th Meridian, which is sort of the line that cuts Texas in half and kind of moves north through Kansas and Nebraska and up into the upper Midwest. And that's a line that Western historians usually use to demarcate the eastern border of the West, because it's where rainfall kind of shifts. And west of there, there are only 20 inches or so a year of rain, and that requires irrigation for crop growing. And so that's one of the ways that environmental historians kind of define the West. There are lots of other ways to define it, but I'm trying to convince Civil War historians and people who read Civil War history to start thinking about that region as the West, and then we'll just call the Trans-Mississippi the Trans-Mississippi.
Ah, well, frankly, after having read your book, I think that's a great way to do it, to be perfect.
Fantastic. I'm glad I convinced you.
Well, Mary in Hudson has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Yes. I'm very interested in this topic. My grandfather, great-grandfather, Joseph Farmer, fought in the Civil War in the West. And my parents discovered this after going down to the Wisconsin State Historical Society. We have his picture, and they found quite a few letters that he had written at the end of the war. I think he had died of rheumatism, and so he was getting his pension at the end of the war. But my aunt always told me that there's a book from 1950 called Rifles for Waddy, and it was that told the story of that part of the war.
Do you know that book, Megan?
Yes, I know of that book. And that is about the Indian chief, Stand Waddy, who fought for the Confederacy during the war. And this is part of the Indian Territory. And so part of that Trans-Mississippi Western Theater, because as I was just telling Larry, Civil War historians tend to refer to the Trans-Mississippi West as the West. So if your ancestor, if Joseph was fighting in the Trans-Mississippi, they were probably talking about him fighting in the Western theater. So he was probably not engaged in any of the actions that I talk about in the book, which are in the Southwest, in New Mexico, and what would become Arizona.
Arizona, yeah.
But what is interesting, there were some soldiers who were, there were a lot of Midwesterners, actually, who ended up in Colorado in the late 1850s as part of the Gold Rush, and they signed up for the Union Army and fought in the Southwest, and then they were actually sent after the Union was successful and pushed the Confederates back to Texas, they were actually sent to the Trans-Mississippi, to Indian Territory, and exactly the region where Joseph would have been fighting. They spent the rest of the war engaging in guerrilla warfare against Confederates.
Very interesting. Mary, thanks. Does that help, Mary?
Yes, very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, so your book, primarily, it's about Texas, because a lot of Confederates came from Texas to, well, maybe sort of lay that out for us.
Sure, of course. So, you know, we were talking before about why the Confederates wanted the West, and they acted very quickly. In the first summer of the war, in the summer of 1861, the first contingent of Texas troops kind of marched from San Antonio all the way to El Paso on the border of Mexico and West Texas, and kind of the furthest west that the Confederacy existed at that point. And there's a guy, John Robert Baylor, who's one of the nine people. You'll start the book with him and his Mounted Texas Volunteers, who invade New Mexico in July of 1861. And a larger army of 3,000 Texans, led by Henry Hopkins Sibley, follow them in October and November, December of 61, and establish themselves in El Paso and then also in southern New Mexico, and then move north to fight the Union troops. So that army was almost entirely made up of Texans. They were sort of homegrown soldiers there invading New Mexico, whereas the Union army was much more kind of heterogeneous and diverse, and actually was the most racially diverse army of any army during the war. Although I will say, just in reference to the former caller, there were a lot of Native communities that were involved in all kinds of Civil War actions on both sides in all different theaters. Historians think about 20,000 Native people were soldiers during the war, some of them mustering in officially and fighting as Union and Confederate soldiers or as scouts and spies. So there's still a lot of work to be done around that. I think it's a really fascinating element of the war that we don't usually think about.
Yeah, and there was some skepticism, might be a polite way to put it, among the Union, as I remember you talking about, wondering about the capabilities of some of those folks and being able, could they fight or not? It turns out they could.
Right, yeah. This is, so the Union Army that kind of came together to defend New Mexico against this Confederate invasion of Texans was a really interesting group. There were some kind of professional Army guys who had already been in the military and were stationed throughout the West, and the commander there, E.R.S. Canby, brought them all together along the Rio Grande. Then there were those Colorado miners who came down in kind of two groups during the war, and then Hispano New Mexicans, and that was the bulk of Canby's army, and they were mostly in the First New Mexico, commanded by some white officers, some Hispano officers, and then their ultimate commander was Kit Carson, who is, you know, someone I think most Americans know about and associate with the West, but never have maybe even never heard that he was a colonel in the Union Army. And Canby gave him that particular post because he was fluent in Spanish. And so he could actually kind of command men in the field in both Spanish and English, which was great. But Hispano New Mexicans were signing up for the war to defend their own homes, right?
Yeah.
From Texas invasion. And so they had a real stake in the fight. And there were also Pueblo and Ute scouts and spies who were also working for the Union Army here. So it was a really kind of interesting mix. And yes, Anglo soldiers didn't really think much of Hispano soldiers, but there have been a lot of historians, Jerry Thompson in particular, who has been working in this field to really try to recover the Hispano soldiers' experience during the war and to argue that they were not cowards, as the Anglos had thought they were. They were, of course, green soldiers, as most soldiers were during the war in all theaters, right?
Yeah, like, right.
Nobody had any experience fighting this kind of war before 1861. And so, but they actually did, in the Battle of El Verde in particular, they fought admirably and with courage. And Kit Carson actually filed several reports attesting to that.
Carson was an interesting, you'd have a little aside about him. You know, he was out there, he'd lived there for 30 years or something, and all this had, stories had been written about him that he wasn't even aware of, I guess, and he was a really popular guy, but didn't know why.
Yeah, he's such an interesting, I mean, he was by far the most famous person in the West in this period. And maybe Jim Bridger, who was another famous scout, was as famous, but I don't think anyone was more famous than Kit Carson. And in fact, almost every other person in the book of the nine people I talk about Carson and meeting him and hearing things about him and hearing rumors that he was in the field and were they going to meet him in the field of battle. And because everyone knew who he was, he'd been the scout with Fremont in the 1840s, and Fremont had written about him and their kind of adventures together across the West and in California. And then he was this very popular dime novel hero, and he really had no idea. So he was an interesting figure. I will say, though, that I struggled with him a little bit because he is such a mythic personality.
Yeah.
I really wanted to give readers a sense of his whole self, that he was, he kept trying after the Confederates left, he kept trying to resign his post. And James Carleton, who had known him from their time together, James Carleton had been a career military guy and had brought troops from California into New Mexico and took over the department. He wanted Carson to stay on, and he had known him and really admired him and sort of, maybe even had a kind of man crush on him in some way. But like, he really wanted him to stay because he wanted him to lead his campaigns against Navajos and Apaches.
Yeah.
And so he refused to let him resign from the army. And then, so Carson, even though he was somewhat unwilling in the beginning, he was a very efficient and brutal commander in those campaigns.
Yeah. And as long as we're on those campaigns, Mangus Coloradus was a revered Chiricahua Apache chief who battled Carson, I guess, or his people, and it didn't end well for him.
It did not. Mangus Coloradus was such an interesting person. First of all, he's the oldest protagonist in the book. He was 70. At the time the Civil War broke out, which I think is just amazing. Like, not only is it amazing he lived that long just in terms of the general, sort of average lifespan of people living in North America at the time, but here's a man who's a war leader, and he had been engaged in battles with, first with Mexicans and then Hispano-New Mexicans for years, and had been injured multiple times and had never succumbed to those injuries. And he was very respected, and he was actually quite famous also throughout the Southwest. Everyone knew who he was and what he looked like. By all accounts, he was this sort of very tall man with this huge head, very imposing. And he was a very successful leader, not just because he turned to war all the time, but actually he was very adept at diplomacy, and he knew how to read a situation, and he knew how to kind of look at the people coming into a pecheria, which is their territory, and consider how he was going to deal with them. So sometimes he charged them fees if they were just rolling through. Sometimes he established peace accords with them. Sometimes he would sign treaties that gave him rations, and other times he would make war upon them, and that, against Hispano New Mexicans and Americans who came later. So he really began to fight the U.S. Army kind of right as the Civil War was beginning, and that was because of a sort of disastrous attack on his people at a place called Apache Pass, which is in southern Arizona today. And so they were actually, the Chiricahua Apaches were at war with the U.S. Army before the Confederates were. But they, like the Navajos, really kind of saw the Civil War, the sort of fight between the Union and the Confederacy, as a war they could exploit. So they raided wagon trains and corrals and army camps and siphoned up all kinds of horses and mules and cattle and provisions and weapons, and really were quite effective in destabilizing the Union and Confederate war efforts in that first year of 1861 and 62. And this was why James Carleton then turned his attention to Mangus Coloradus and the Chiricahua Apaches in the fall of 1862. And ultimately, the Union Army captured him in January of 1863 and killed him while they were imprisoning him. And that actually launched what we know, I think, more popularly as the Apache Wars of the 70s and 80s. That conflict continued for more than 20 years because Chiricahuas were so outraged that Mangus Coloradus had been kind of lured into a parley and then brutally murdered.
And beheaded.
And beheaded, yes.
Which?
That was... Apaches believe that you go into the next life with the body that you have when you die. And so to be beheaded was this just terrible betrayal of the person that you've already killed, because they would have to go through the next life without their head. And so that was even more enraging. And Chiricahua Apaches, basically led by Geronimo and Cochise, led resistant actions against the U.S. Army for the next 20 years because of that.
I did want to bring up, and we're getting a little closer to time here, but I did want to bring up that the women, you have two women you featured, Juanita, a Navajo weaver who resisted Union campaigns against her people, and Louisa Hawkins Canby, who was a Union Army wife but nursed the Confederate soldiers in Santa Fe.
Yeah, so Louisa Canby, I wanted, first of all, to be able to, you know, talk about women because they were there and they were involved in the conflict as civilians. And so they give the reader both a view of what war was like for people who were not engaged directly in the battle, but who were experiencing its effects. And so Louisa Canby was married to ERS Canby, and she was in Santa Fe throughout this conflict and was there when it became an occupied city. The Confederates actually successfully marched all the way up the Rio Grande and took Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And then they marched a little past that and had two major battles with the Union Army and then had to retreat back to Santa Fe. And that's where she nursed those soldiers. And one of the reasons that she did that is because that's what she had always done.
It was what she had always done. And, you know, here we are out of time. Megan, I wish we had more time. I want to thank you so much for writing this book and for talking with us today about it. I wish we had more time. But I thank you so much, and I highly recommend your book. Thank you. Megan.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Megan Nelson. Her book is called The Three-Cornered War, The Union Confederacy and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. We're going to switch gears again because we've got some pretty entertaining things to talk about going on in wintertime here in Wisconsin. Here's a particularly unique sporting activity that is worth checking out.
Are you searching for something new to do in the snow? Search no more. We recommend you head to Rice Lake, Wisconsin next weekend for the Spurs and Skis Skijoring Stampede. Sounds like a super sojourn to us. To find out more, we have Nikki Repka on the line with us. She is the executive director of Rice Lake Tourism. Hi, Nikki. Thanks for talking with us about your event.
Okay.
So, Nikki, the first thing that we need to know is, what is skijoring?
Well, basically what it is, it's a horse, a skier or snowboarder, and a rope. And what they do is the horse pulls the skier or the snowboarder on an obstacle course on snow-made jumps. Some of them go actually pretty fast, and it's timed. And then we give prizes at the end.
Okay. Well, where do the contestants come from? Are they pretty much local?
No, we get contestants from basically all over the place. We've had them from Iowa, Illinois. We had one come in, which was kind of crazy. I don't know if they were in the area or they just follow this around, but from the Montana area, where a lot of them actually do this sort of event.
Okay, so this is something that it's not so common in Wisconsin, but common elsewhere?
Yes, Montana, it's big there.
Okay, so how long has Rice Lake been hosting this event?
This is our second annual.
Okay, so what was the reaction last year when you had it?
I'm super excited to come next year.
Okay.
So we ended up with over 1,000 spectators, which is great for a first year. We had a lot of registrants that couldn't wait to come again this year. So for our first year,
that's a lot.
It was excellent.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell those who are listening right now where and when this event is going to be taking place.
This will be at the UWEC Barron County College. Saturday, March 7th, the event starts at 1 o'clock and goes until 4:30.
Okay.
Ticket prices are $10.
And what else are attendees going to find at the event?
We'll have a bonfire. We're going to have food trucks, a big warming tent. There will be beer. And we are also adding a snow sculpture event this year that will be judged at noon the morning of.
Wow, that's a lot of fun. Do you have lots of snow up there?
We do, but we've had a lot of warm temperatures here recently, so we're hoping for a cold spell to come and maybe a little more snow, because in order for the horses to be able to run on something like that, it either has to be packed down really tight,
mm-hmm.
And not be a super warm day. So I know that's not great for spectators, but it's great for our horses.
It's great for the horses, right. Now, for those who aren't familiar, tell us where Rice Lake is located.
We're the hub between Duluth, Eau Claire, the cities, so we're kind of right in the central location.
You're about 4 hours away from Madison, right?
Yeah, four and a half hours.
All right, so we can kind of pinpoint that. And how do people get tickets?
You can either get them online at www.ricelakewis.com, or you can just buy them the day of.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us, Nikki. We appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
Celebrate winter at the Spurs and Skis Skajoring Stampede next weekend. Later in the month, Everyone is Irish at the Shamrocks and Shenanigans event in Plymouth. Satisfy your sweet tooth at the Maple Sugar Camp in Brilliant, and watch a spider spin life lessons at the St. Croix Festival Theater's presentation of Charlotte's Web. If you have an event you'd like to tell us about, email timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org and find links to the events we talked about today at wpr.org/timeout. I'm Jill Nadeau. Until next month, get out and explore, dream, and discover.
Sounds to me like a wild ride, whether you're watching it or you're participating in it. That is a really cool little story from Jill there. Well, I tell you what, it's great to talk about things going on in the state. Maybe you do have an event, as Jill was saying, for our Time Out Wisconsin segment. Love to hear from you. Send an email to timeoutwisconsin@wpr.org. We'll have more for you next month, and then enjoy taking time to get out and explore Wisconsin. Just to take a look at what's coming up tomorrow on the show, it's Garden Talk, of course. Lisa Johnson will be back to answer your garden questions. Hope you can join us for that at 11 or catch the rebroadcast at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.